12 tonight. We'll get through verse 6 of chapter 12 of Revelation. Let me go ahead and read those verses. And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. And she was with child, and she cried out, being in labor and in pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads were 7 diadems, and his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven, and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she gave birth, he might devour her child. And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God, so that there she might be nourished for 1,260 days. Well, as we said, we've reached the point in Revelation where it's coming to the conclusion of the judgments of God, the wrath of God, that the seventh trumpet is sounded, which is the bowl judgments and the final judgments. But before John gets to his description of these bowl judgments, first verses, chapters 12 through 14, give us the background against which these judgments take place, the conditions under which these judgments, both spiritual and temporal conditions, what's seen and what's unseen at the time that these judgments are going to occur. And again, it's to show the readers that not only are these judgments deserved, but they're demanded by the wickedness and the evil. And because of this age-old long rebellion against God and His kingdom. And as we see, all this rebellion, what chapter 12 is revealing, is that all this rebellion that's taking place, all the evil that goes on in the world, all the rebellion against God and His truth, all the corruption, all the deceit, everything, is all spiritual in origin. Spiritual forces are behind all of these things that take place on earth. As Paul said in Ephesians 6:12, before he launches into his description of the full armor of God, or in the midst of it, he said, and the reason for putting on this full armor of God is for our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. That's who we... And so there's just been this long war against God. And chapter 12 is showing the origin of this war and how it's played out over the course and history of the world. And so we can really divide chapter 12 into three parts. You have verse 1 through 6 kind of gives us the plot as well as the combatants. You have the woman, you have the child, and you have the serpent introduced in verses 1 through 6. And then verses 7 through 12 give us a glimpse into the spiritual warfare that's going on, this warfare in heaven. And then verses 13 through 17 give us the outcome and the effect of this warfare on earth and the temporal earthly impact of this warfare. You know, today we live in a day, and really throughout all of human history, pretty much, mankind has always looked for some sort of naturalistic explanation for things. There were times where there was much superstition where people would ascribe everything to spiritual forces, mystical beings, that even rocks and trees were inhabited by evil or good spirits. But today, people are always looking for some sort of naturalistic explanation, some naturalistic cause to the events, the things that are around us. Usually it's centered in man. You know, we have environmental issues. What's the cause of that? What's the problem? Well, it's all man-centered. It must be climate change, global warming. It's something man is doing that's to create these natural disasters. Or whether it's a social issue, society's disintegrating, things are coming apart, there's social injustice, whatever. That's some failure on the part of man. Whether it's an economic issue, well, that, again, something on the part of man, political, whatever it is. There's some sort of natural force, even with the natural world, forces of so-called nature, as though man can actually control these things. And of course, all this comes from the fact that, as Paul told the Corinthians, you're looking at things outwardly. You're looking at things as they appear outwardly. You're blind to the spiritual realities behind all of this. And so people look for natural explanations, natural causes for the things around. And as a result, if they're looking for things that are naturalistic causes, they're going to look for naturalistic solutions instead of spiritual solutions, realizing that all the things that we face have as their source spiritual realities. That the ultimate cause of all the evil in the world, all the wars, all the poverty, all the social injustice, everything that man deals with in this world, the ultimate cause of all of it is rebellion against God and His Word and His way. The prophet Hosea over in Hosea chapter 5, verse 11, states the cause for the judgment that had come upon the northern kingdom. Ephraim is oppressed, crushed in judgment, because he was determined to follow man's command. It's Hosea 5:11. They're determined to follow man's way, man's wisdom, not God's way. How did Satan deceive Eve? 2 Corinthians 11:3. But he deceived her mind by leading her away from purity and simplicity of devotion to God. In other words, he set her mind on the things of this earth, on things of the flesh, not on the things above. They were focused on the temporal, not on the spiritual. And so she was led astray. And so if the things in the world, if we always attribute those to natural causes, then we'll be ill-equipped to fight spiritual battles and to recognize spiritual traps, spiritual deceptions, spiritual enemies, and spiritual dangers. Remember what Peter warned those he was writing to in 1 Peter 2:11 when he said, "Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul." So the fleshly lust, the temporal thing, can have a spiritual impact. It wages war against the soul. It has spiritual consequences. Satan can use temporal things and use those things to have spiritual objectives and spiritual consequences, to set the mind and the affections and the will on them and draw them away like he did Eve. So Satan's attacks always have spiritual objectives. And he'll use temporal means to achieve these spiritual objectives. And it's part of Christian maturity to be able to see, to recognize the spiritual reality behind the natural temporal causes and arm ourselves with spiritual armor and spiritual weapons. To be able to see these things and discern them. And so for God, here in Revelation, for God's final judgments to be rightly understood, where people don't look at them from a temporal perspective and say, "Wow, that seems awful harsh." God, here in chapter 12, pulls back the veil and gives a glimpse into the hidden spiritual forces behind the final events that were going to be transpire before God brings His final judgment on the earth and before the return of Christ to rule and reign on earth. And so here we see the entities and the persons involved in the climax of this long war against God that has raged since Satan's fall. So we see here in verses 1 through 6, which we'll get through tonight, Satan's attempts to prevent the appearing of the promised seed of the woman. Remember the very first thing that God promised after the fall of Adam and Eve, Genesis 3:15, was that the seed of the woman would crush the head of the serpent. And ever since then, Satan has been trying to intervene and prevent the coming about of that seed who would crush the head of the serpent. Cain killed Abel. So it can't be Cain because he committed murder. Abel's dead. It can't be him. Seth is born. But then there's the corruption of the lineage, the corruption of all of mankind prior to the flood to corrupt the seed of Seth. And on it goes throughout the rest of the history of mankind. Satan constantly trying to prevent the coming about of this promised seed. Whether it was through the corruption of mankind after the flood at the Tower of Babel, whether it was through trying to interpose with an alternate plan for bringing about the promised lineage and a carnal plan for having children between Abraham and Sarah and substituting Hagar and producing Ishmael, whether it was Pharaoh instituting a program to kill all the male children in Israel, whether it was Haman in his plot to wipe out Israel, whether it was the plot of Athaliah to destroy all the royal offspring and only one descendant of David was saved out of all of that. And so Satan is constantly attempted to prevent the appearing of the promised seed. Herod's going out to kill all the male children 2 years and under after learning of the birth of Jesus. So there's always been this attempt to prevent the coming about of this promised seed. Well, chapter 12, verse 1 introduces the woman. A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun. Now, pagan religions abound with satanically inspired counterfeits, even of the woman and child. Here we see the description of the woman. But then Babylonian religions had their woman and child cult. The Egyptians did. We have a woman and child cult today. It's called Roman Catholicism. There's all this satanically inspired woman and child cult that's out there where the woman is worshipped as well as the child. Well, here, the woman is introduced. And John's description of the woman here, a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon, and under her feet and on her head a crown of 12 stars. His description is based on Joseph's dream over in Genesis 37, where, remember, Joseph is given a dream that would, first he had a dream of sheaves of wheat that were bowing down to others, and he told his brothers, and they got angry at him. But in verse 9 it says he had still another dream and related it to his brothers and said, "Lo, I have had still another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." And he related it to his father and to his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground?" So Jacob here understood the meaning of the dream. The sun represented Jacob, the moon Rachel, the 11 stars Joseph's 11 brothers. And he's saying, "Are we going to come bow down to you?" But it's a depiction of the Abrahamic covenant where there would be this promised seed, the seed promises of the Abrahamic covenant. And of course, this woman that's depicted here is not a literal woman. Rather, we're told she is a great sign. So she's meant to be symbolic, a sign for something else, representative of an entity or a group. And the question is, what is this entity or this group which the woman represents? Well, no surprise that Roman Catholicism says it's Mary, but that's not possible, and even some more recent Catholic theologians have even rejected that view. Some have wanted to identify the woman as the church, but the church didn't give birth to Jesus, so it can't be the church. So, the most logical and the most consistent is that this woman is representing the nation of Israel. She's clothed with the sun, an allusion to Jacob and the covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? So there's the allusion to that. The moon under her feet, this is an allusion to Rachel. Placing in the role of submission, Mary submitted, even though the woman's not Mary, still it's this submission to the will of God. Israel is even sometimes referred to Rachel when Herod kills all the 2-year-old and under. Remember, Matthew said it's Rachel weeping for her children. And then the crown of 12 stars, again, is representing the 12 tribes of Israel. So the Messiah comes from national Israel, and it's been Satan's attempts to destroy or to corrupt national Israel and to prevent the coming about of this child. Everything, even from inciting Israel into idolatry to where they would actually sacrifice their own children on the altars of Molech. And right down to the temptation of Jesus, and of course Satan's ultimate attempt to destroy Jesus was the crucifixion. Verse 2 here tells us the condition of the woman. She was with child. That, just the verb there, she was with child, is in the present tense. Now, indicating this was the nation, this was the condition. There was this expectation of a birth of a Messiah throughout the history of the nation of Israel. They were looking for that. There was this expectation. And in fact, the expectation was very high right during the time of Jesus. Remember in John chapter 1, I think it's around verse 19, where the Pharisees, the religious leaders, send representatives to John the Baptist and ask him, "Who are you? Are you the Messiah? Are you the one?" Even John the Baptist had to send disciples to Jesus to ask him, "Are you the expected one? Or you're the one we're looking for?" And so there's this heightened expectation. And there was always this expectation of the coming Messiah. And it's stated that she cried out, being in labor and in pain, to give birth. Just that word, in pain, again, it's in the present tense. Something, the word literally means physical or mental torture. And it's the only time it's used in the Bible for giving birth. And again, this was the condition of Israel since their captivity and the release from captivity, or ever since their foundation. They're looking for this Messiah. And really, isn't this should be the expectation and longing of believers now? What did Paul say, remember, over in Romans 8, 22-23, that the whole creation groans now, like in labor and childbirth, longing to be released, longing for this promised kingdom. So here's the woman she's introduced, and she's a sign, representative. And she's in labor to bring forth this promised child. Then there's another sign, verse 3, and another sign appeared in heaven. And behold, just that word behold is there to call special attention to this sign. A great red dragon. Now, Israel's enemies are often presented as monsters, beasts, in the Old Testament. Egypt is Assyria and Babylon are often called Leviathan, or dragon, or serpent. And Daniel chapter 7 knows that there are four nations that are depicted, and each nation is depicted as a beast, and these four nations correspond to those that were represented in the statue in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, which Daniel interpreted. There was the head of gold, which was Babylon. There was the arms and chest of silver, which was Media Persia. There was the belly of bronze, which was Greece. And there were the legs of iron, which was the Roman Empire. But then there's the feet of iron and clay mixed with the ten toes. That's going to be another kingdom. But these four beasts, the ones that represent Babylon, Media Persia, Greece, and Rome, are represented in Daniel chapter 7 as just terrible, terrible beasts. Now, who is this great red dragon? Well, it's obvious that it's Satan, just from verse 9 of chapter 12. A great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who was called the devil and Satan. So we don't have to guess who this dragon is or who he's representing. And he's depicted as being great. His power, his authority, in red, indicating just his bloody nature. He comes to kill and to destroy, right? It's the way Jesus describes Satan. He comes to kill and to destroy. And he is having seven heads, ten horns, and on his head were seven diadems. Now this is going to be explained more fully. Right now it's just basically introducing it and be premature to get into it right now. But it's explained more fully, this imagery, over in Revelation 17, 9 and 10. But just for now, suffice it to say that it's in depicting this worldwide, universal domination. Jesus called Satan the ruler of this world. Which brings up a question: how does Satan rule in this world? Well, again, 12:9 tells us, who deceives the whole world. Satan rules by deception. He rules by deception, by deceit. How did Satan get to Eve? He deceived her. Even Eve said, "The serpent deceived me." Satan is the father of lies. And so, he rules by deceit. And he does all this to incite opposition against God, against Jesus Christ, against His kingdom, and against His people. But it's all ruled and done by deceit. And as we said in our study when we went through indwelling sin, that this deceit of Satan is simply presenting things to the mind as something other than they really are. How did Satan present the forbidden fruit, the tree, to Eve? As something other than it really was. It will make you wise. It will make you be like God. It promises things that it can't deliver. It makes things appear other than they really are. Moreover, Paul in Ephesians 4:22, telling the Ephesians that in reference to your former manner of life, you lay aside the old self, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lusts of deceit. See, all lust is deceitful. And it presents things to the mind as something other than they really are. Either in their nature, that they're not really sinful, or in their causes, that the causes are other than the sinful lusts and desires. There's something external to us. Or in their consequences. They're really not as harmful as the Bible says they are. So, this deceit of Satan, it hides what should be seen. It represents things other than they really are. Remember what Proverbs 14:12 says, there is a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof is a way of death. It takes a lot of deceit to make the way of death seem right. So it promises what it can't deliver. That's why Jesus said people were failed to bear fruit. The seed that didn't come up because they were choked out by what? The deceitfulness of riches. Riches promise what they can't deliver. The author of Hebrews 5:14 states, solid food is for the mature, who because of practice have their senses trained to discern good and evil. See, this is part of Christian maturity, is to discern good and evil. To not be sucked in by the deceits of sin. To allow things to be presented to us and be called something other than they really are. Otherwise, it's to be blind what should be seen, to what should be considered, and what should be known. And so Satan dominates through deceit. And this is what he has done since the fall in the garden. Since he deceived Eve, he has been dominating through deceit. And he does so today. And Satan's not alone in his opposition to God. Verse 4, his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she gave birth, he might devour her child. Just that verb, his tail swept away. Literally, it means to be pulled, to be dragged by force. It's the same word that's used in John 21:8. For when the disciples who have caught this tremendous load of fish after the resurrection of Jesus, and they recognize this is Jesus, and it's the word that's used for them dragging the net full of fish ashore. Or it's used in Acts 3 for dragging away enemies, or for the enemies of the gospel, dragging away people to prison, or it's actually Paul dragging people away when he was raging against the church and going against, after the stoning of Stephen, it said, Saul began ravaging the church, entering house after house and dragging off men and women. He put them in prison. And so this is the force of this word. It's used five times in the New Testament. And this is what it always means. It's to drag away by force, to draw away by force. Just in highlighting the power and the authority of Satan. And Paul wrote in Romans 13:1, it was in relation to human government, but it's still true that there is no authority except that comes from God. Satan has no authority except what's given to him by God. But the authority he has been given is great authority, because over in chapter 13, verse 2 of Revelation, it says, and the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like those of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. So he has much authority to, and so he can give it. So there's this war, this rebellion in heaven, which resulted in Satan and his angels being thrown down to the earth. He's the great accuser. Remember in Job when it says the sons of men can't present themselves before God, and God asked Satan, where have you been? He said, I've been roaming around throughout the earth Peter says in 1 Peter 5:7-8 that Satan is like a roaring lion roaming around seeking whom he may devour. They've been thrown to the earth. And now the objective, once they've been thrown to the earth, is to destroy the promised seed of the woman. The target is the child, not the woman. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth so that when she gave birth, he might devour her child. In other words, ever since the fall, ever since the promise of the seed of the woman who had crushed the head of the serpent, he has been ready to pounce. He has been ready to seize any opportunity to destroy, to devour this child when it comes. And as we said, all through the Old Testament, there are all these attempts made to prevent and to stop the coming about of this promised child. Which, of course, the ultimate was the crucifixion. There were Jews, Pilate, Herod, the Gentiles, Romans, arrayed against Jesus to do whatever the predetermined plan of God had determined to happen. But it was all instigated and inspired by Satan. Remember in Judas, when Judas went out to betray, it says, then Satan entered Judas. Only time in the Bible where it ever says Satan actually entered anybody. Satan himself actually entered into anybody. It was all to destroy Jesus. And this is what Satan has always been ready to do. But he was thwarted. Always was thwarted. And verse 5 shows this divine protection. And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who is to rule all the nations. Literally, who is about to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was called up to God and to His throne. Here's the incarnation of Jesus. There's the birth of Jesus. And said that He is about to rule with a rod of iron. Literally, to destroy with a rod of iron. This is what we saw over in chapter 2, verse 27, where this same passage is quoted by Jesus. In His message to the church of Thyatira, He who overcomes and he who keeps my deeds until the end, to him I will give authority over the nations. He shall rule them with a rod of iron, as the vessels of the potter are broken to pieces. He's just going to smash them. As I have also received authority from my Father. So here Jesus is giving this authority even to those who overcome. But He is the one who possesses it. And He will rule all the nations. He will destroy, crush all the nations with this rod of iron. It is, with the rod of iron, it can't be broken, it can't be resisted. He's going to destroy all the nations to establish His kingdom on earth. He's not going to start with what's here. He's going to wipe it out with a clean slate. All that opposes Him is going to be gone. It's going to be killed or thrown into the lake of fire. Even Satan will be bound for 1,000 years. So all that is there to oppose Him will be done away with, smashed, broken. And He will crush any opposition that occurs during those 1,000 years with a rod of iron. It says that He was caught up to God in His throne. That verb, caught up, harpazo, it's the same word that's used with Philip after the Ethiopian eunuch. He was caught up, taken away. It's the word that's used in 1 Thessalonians 4:17, that the saints will be caught up in the air with the Lord. It's actually where we get our word rapture from, because the word harpazo is translated in Latin as rapture in the Latin Vulgate, and that's where we get our word rapture from. This being caught up, referring to Christ's ascension. And he was called up to God and to his throne. Which, of course, was where Jesus said, remember over in Revelation 3:21, in the church to the Laodicea, he who overcomes, I will allow them to sit down with me on my throne, just as I overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. And again, this is all a reference referring back to alluding to Psalm 2, specifically verses 8 and 9, referring to the Son, the Messiah, who would come, whom God would give the make the nations his footstool, and he would rule and reign with a rod of iron. In other words, he's out of reach of Satan. All the schemes, all the plots have failed to prevent his coming. They failed to defeat his plan and purpose. And now Satan himself is defeated. Which is what Paul said over in Colossians chapter 2, verse 15. That when he had disarmed the rulers and authorities, he made a public display of them. This is what conquering generals would do, especially conquering Roman generals. They would bring in all their captives that they would enslave and just make a public display of them, parade them through the streets, and letting everybody know this is a conquered and vanquished people. And this is what Jesus did. With Satan and his angels, he disarmed the rulers and authorities. He made a public display of them, having triumphed over them through him. So he's the victor. Well, Satan's focus of attack now shifts to the woman, because again, this is all talking about the events. It's given a lot of background information, but it comes up to the current events, to where Satan is instituting his final program on earth. And the woman will flee into the wilderness, because during the tribulation, God is dealing with Israel. He is purifying and cleansing Israel, making them fit to go into his promised, covenanted kingdom. But it says the woman fled into the wilderness. Now, in the Old Testament, the wilderness was what for Israel? It was a place of discipline. It was a place of instruction. It was a place of preparation. It was even in some way a place of safety, because their shoes didn't wear out, their clothes didn't wear out, they had food given to them, they were nourished, they were taken care of, and they were somewhat protected from all the warring factions that were going on around them. But they were, remember what Jesus, or what God told Israel through Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 8, I led you into the wilderness for 40 years, I let you be hungry so that you would learn that man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. So it was a place of instruction, a place of discipline, a place of preparation, as well as a place of safety. And this is where Israel, the woman representing Israel during the tribulation period, will flee into the wilderness, and specifically the last half of the tribulation period, because the time frame is given that she's going to be nourished for 1,260 days, 3.5 years. Over in Isaiah chapter 26, verse 21, chapter 26 is a song, Israel's kingdom song. But in verses 20 through 21, toward the end of chapter 26, it says, come, my people, enter into your rooms and close your doors behind you. Hide for a little while until indignation runs its course. For behold, the Lord is about to come out from his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity, and the earth will reveal her bloodshed and will no longer cover her slain. So here Israel is being hid while God pours out his wrath on the rest of the earth. So they flee into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God. The word prepared, it's in the perfect tense, indicating an action that occurred in the past with the results of it continuing up to the present time, at least of the writer. In other words, this is a place that was prepared. It's prepared by God. He is the source of the place in the wilderness. He's the source of the protection. It's prepared by His command, and they're to be nourished. Literally, it's that some translations say so that there she might be nourished. Actually, it's a third person plural, not a singular. So it's where they might nourish her. Present tense. Continuously during this time. Who's the they that is nourishing them? It's just an indefinite pronoun. Indistinguishable. Kind of the same as what we find over in chapter 10, verse 11. Where John said, "And they said to me, you must prophesy again concerning many peoples, nations, tongues, and kings." It's by referring to angelic beings, heavenly beings, just like God gave and nourished Israel in the wilderness with manna, with quail, with water from a rock, all by supernatural means. He is going to provide and nourish and care for them by supernatural means for 3.5 years. So this introduces the players, the plot. And it just shows that God knows how to make a distinction between the righteous and the wicked. Remember over in Genesis 18 with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and Abraham is pleading with God, kind of bargaining for Sodom and Gomorrah. In verse 25 he says, "Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly?" God doesn't treat the righteous and the wicked alike. He knows how to make a distinction between those who are His and those who are not His. Just as Peter said concerning Lot in 2 Peter 2, verse 7, "If he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, for by what he saw and heard, that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day with their lawless deeds, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment." God knows how to make a distinction. But there is this coming, this culmination of this long war against God. Right now it's still raging. And this is why Satan has turned his attacks to the woman. Jesus is out of his reach. He's vanquished. He's been led captive. But he's still prowling about. And he's turning his attention to his attacks now to the church. As Paul said, we don't war against flesh and blood. There's a war going on. He's still deceiving. He's still blinding. Which is why we must not be ignorant of his schemes. Because so many are blind to them right now. So many.